All right. All right, well, it is a real privilege for me to be here with you, and I should say, I haven't yet been back up to Madoc to see the progress, but I'm teaching a course on apologetics in Ottawa this Saturday, so I'm traveling through on Friday, and I do plan on stopping and seeing the property. I am interested in what's going on there and very excited that the Lord's, in His grace, bringing this long-term project to a point of completion. Now, I was asked to speak about the new atheism today, and in receiving that assignment, I've struggled a little bit with how to approach it. There's a lot that can be said, there's a lot that probably shouldn't be said, and so I'm trying to balance out what's the path of wisdom. And so I actually thought this might be very helpful for me. And I realized that as pastors, we're not always renowned for our honesty, so today you have to be honest, okay? I am interested to know, this actually will be very helpful for me. How many of you, you can put up your hand if you have, how many of you have read Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion? How many of you read that book? Okay, good. I'm very bad at guessing how many people are here, but if there's 30 people here, 25 people here, 25? Okay, so we would be running around 8% of attendance has read that book. Okay, how many of you read Christopher Hitchens' book, God is Not Great? Okay, down to about 4%. Sam Harris, The End of Faith, or Letter to a Christian Nation? One? Okay. Anything by Daniel Dennett? No. All right. Very good. Well, those are the main people who comprise what someone's referred to as the four horsemen of the new atheist apocalypse. Okay. Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and Christopher Hitchens. Now, one of the things that is important to understand is that just like with the new perspective on Paul, the new perspective on justification, having the word new in a title does not mean that it's always current. And so when we come to the new perspective on Paul, there's a sense in which it's not really new anymore. And when we come to the new atheist, it's very important to know that the new atheism was new when these four people were beginning to publish best-selling books. But the new atheism isn't exactly new today. All of the main publications of the new atheists are over a decade old. And in a sense, we'd want to say, well, that doesn't really mean that they're not important today. Well, of course not. Nietzsche was writing over 100 years ago. He's still important in terms of being a thinker and someone who shapes culture. Michel Foucault has been dead for decades. And yet Foucault, just a few years ago, was still the most cited author in all of the humanities in North America. So when you come to students who are getting university education in the arts of any kind, in any of the humanities, Foucault is the most often cited thinker. So that gives us a bit of a perspective that you don't need to be writing currently to still be shaping culture and education. The new atheists, however, really sort of hit into a sweet spot where there was the burgeoning of the internet, social media, and so although they were very influential and very important, a decade ago, attracting all kinds of attention, to be honest, we're already seeing a vast waning in their influence and in their name recognition today. So we just want to be aware of that just because we're referring to them as the new atheists, it doesn't mean that moniker is actually an accurate way of describing them today. I mean, you go into university campuses today, and it's not like people are reading, you know, Hitchens or Dawkins, or some more are reading Harris. He's just 50 years old, and he's still writing books. Christopher Hitchens has been dead for over 5 years. His publication record has dried up since then. Dawkins is no longer at Oxford University. He has had a minor stroke, and he has really become a bit of like a Donald Trump figure in terms of Twitter. He's alienated all kinds of people who used to support him. He's offended Muslims, not just by attacking their religion, but by just taking sort of below-the-belt shots at the general intelligence of Muslims. He's offended feminists and women. In general, he's offended people who advocate for those who have special needs. He very famously, a few years ago, sent out a tweet basically suggesting that if you have prenatal testing done and it's revealed that your child has Down syndrome, then the morally correct thing to do would probably be to have an abortion. And you can imagine that not only people who are against abortion had trouble with that, but there's also all kinds of people who are saying, hey, wait a minute, my child, who I love very, very much, has Down syndrome. You know, where do you get off saying that it would have been a morally better choice to terminate their life before they were brought into the world? So he's put his foot in his mouth in so many different ways and alienated so many different people that we're beginning to see almost the prophetic fulfillment of something that Michael Ruse, the great evolutionary philosopher down in Florida, said when Dawkins was first beginning to publish, when he published The God Delusion in 2006. Michael Ruse very famously said, Richard Dawkins makes me embarrassed to be an atheist. And that's sort of been something which more and more people have begun to believe and to hold on to as well as time has gone on. So the four major thinkers, as I mentioned, are Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, and Sam Harris. Richard Dawkins, until a few years ago, was a professor at Oxford University, educated at Oxford, and truly, as is the case with all four of these men, is a brilliant mind. And one of the things that I have done, which has not been right in the past, is I've been very quick to cast these men as idiots. You know, Dawkins is an idiot. Well, a lot of what he says is idiotic, and yet he's brilliant. It's sort of the difference between having a low IQ, and I say this guardedly, and being a fool in the biblical sense of Proverbs. You can be a fool and be incredibly intelligent. Frankly, most of us would not get into Oxford, let alone get a degree from Oxford, let alone be asked to be a professor at Oxford. At least I know that that would be the case for myself. And so the very fact that you're able to become a professor at Oxford means that you're very smart. Now, you may be a fool, biblically speaking, but you have to be very intelligent. You have to have a lot of gray matter to rise up that ladder in terms of academic proficiency. So Dawkins really made his mark as an evolutionary biologist and has profoundly shaped the way that evolution is understood in our world today. His breakthrough book was called The Selfish Gene. And in The Selfish Gene, Dawkins persuasively argues from his worldview that the unit of selection for natural selection in terms of evolution and survival of the fittest, the unit of selection is not the species, nor is it the individual organism. It's the gene. The gene is the unit for natural selection. And this has actually created a whole revolution in terms of nuance in understanding of evolutionary theory in biology. So now we're long past Darwinism, strictly. Today, most biologists would hold to what they refer to as sort of a neo-Darwinian synthesis. And part of that is moving beyond just the organism as the main unit for natural selection and looking at the gene as the unit for natural selection, so that we, as organisms, are merely vehicles for the passing on of genetics. Genes use organisms to perpetuate themselves, okay? Not just the individual organism as a whole unit. Now, this book was published in the 70s and actually is one of the very few publications that has resulted in a major shift in a discipline. So Dawkins is a feted and widely recognized, brilliant, original thinker when it comes to evolutionary biology. And so he's famous in scientific circles all over the world. Had a massive influence in a whole generation of professors and even field biologists in understanding the mechanism of life and passing on genetic material. However, because of his attitude, actually a recent study done in Britain shows that a lot of scientists, the majority of scientists, actually don't like Dawkins. Not because of his scientific research, but again because of some of the other things that we've been mentioning about him. Now, Daniel Dennett, someone who apparently no one here has read, is by far the least well-read of the new atheists, and that's because he's actually, you know, a very intelligent and thoughtful philosopher who writes as a very intelligent and thoughtful philosopher. So he's not publishing the same sort of popular level, you know, diatribes as Harris, Hitchens, and Dawkins. So to read Dennett is actually requires some concentration and some intellectual rigor. Now, Christopher Hitchens, who died of esophageal cancer in 2012, was a political commentator. He is a leftist, a journalist, a contrarian, but an absolutely scathing and brilliant writer. And so one of the things, actually, one of the commonalities, excluding Dennett, although even for a philosopher, Dennett's a pretty good writer, one of the great commonalities of the new atheists is they are excellent in prose. These guys can write, and even when you profoundly disagree with them, even when they're infuriating, it has almost a page-turning quality, at least that I've found. I mean, they're just excellent, excellent writers. Hitchens, probably the best of all of them. I mean, he's a professional writer, taught writing, taught journalism, and has traveled all over the world, you know, using sort of acerbic wit to, you know, poke fun in a satirical way at, you know, everyone that he disagrees with, you know, politically, militarily. And as an original thinker, he also, interestingly enough, comes down on issues in ways that are surprising. Doesn't just sort of sign up for the party line. You know, sometimes you can almost typecast people. You find out what someone believes about something, and you can almost fill in the gaps about what they're going to believe about 10 other things. Hitchens isn't like that. Sometimes he's very creative, comes at things from different angles. His book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, published in 2007, really was a compliment to Dawkins' book. Dawkins tries to approach things from a scientific, philosophical perspective with mixed success and competency. Hitchens is approaching viewing religion through the eyes of a world traveler who's been exposed to the permutations of religions in all sorts of cultures, all sorts of crises. And so these books complement each other. The last book that Hitchens wrote, published posthumously, was a book called Mortality. And if it tracks his experience through diagnosis with terminal esophageal cancer and then treatment and facing death. It's actually a very interesting book. And one of the reasons it's so interesting is that Hitchens is absolute, you know, fire in all of his writings. He's just scathing and fascinating, even when you disagree with him completely. He's got a really interesting intensity. And his book on mortality is completely the opposite. It's almost banal. There's no fire in it at all. There's no raging against death. There's no raging against God. It's just sort of this acquiescence. There's no cowering, no whimpering. It's not going out with a bang. It's not going out with a whimper. It's just almost simply presenting, this is the end. It's merely a fact. Coming to the end of life, no afterlife, must accept it. You know, it's very interesting to see, whereas some atheists, you know, are sort of raging against God to the very end, Hitchens basically just allows himself to slip away. So it's a very, very interesting read. Now, Sam Harris is the youngest of the four. His book, The End of Faith, in 2004, was the first major new atheist publication. He's gone on to write books on morality, the moral landscape, free will, lying, and other topics. Now, Harris has his PhD from UCLA in neuroscience. So again, like, these are not unintelligent people, right? These are very intelligent, highly educated individuals. Dawkins' book sold 3 million copies. That's a lot. And one of the things that, now obviously it didn't sell that many copies to this particular group, as we discovered earlier, but at least it did sell a number of copies. Now, selling copies is not the same as having a book read, of course. There are a lot of Bibles that are bought, which I think sit on people's shelves from one Sunday morning to the next. So we can't just say, well, look how many people are reading the Bible. You can't just look at copies sold and equate that to books read. But certainly someone's reading these sorts of books. 3 million copies is a lot. And it's sort of like Rachel Held Evans. Have you heard of Rachel Held Evans? Feminist, Christian, loosely Christian blogger and author. You look at the number of people. She's very influential in the younger generation. And you look at the number of books that she's selling and the number of people who are following her blog, and you have this this horrible sinking sensation that not everyone is reading her blog today as you are to be conversant with someone who's obviously saying things that are wrong. There are a lot of people who are reading this because they agree with her. And it's the same with Dawkins. You get this, wait a minute, a lot of people are reading this book not just as Christians because they have to be sort of aware of what's shaping culture, but a lot of people are reading this because they agree, clearly. And that's a very, very frightening thing. So to me, the bigger question is this. Not, why are these people attacking religion? Because that's almost the baseline of what caused the new atheist to be labeled new. Dawkins himself, in his memoirs, which I will not even bother asking how many of you have read, Dawkins in his memoirs says that we're not arguing anything new. We don't have any new arguments. So then what was it that was new about them? And this has been one of the criticisms of the books, is it's just a rehashing of what people have been arguing for hundreds of years when it comes to the existence of God and atheism. There's no really original arguments here whatsoever. Some nuance, sure. New data, fine. But in terms of actual originality, there isn't anything. The biggest difference is the stridency. The biggest difference is the tone. Bullying, hectoring, condescending arrogance, which is tied to a feeling of overwhelming moral superiority to people of faith. Not intellectual superiority, although that comes through in spades too, but moral superiority. That is, it is not only stupid to be a Christian. People have said that for a long time. One of the major emphases of the New Atheist is that it is wicked to be a Christian. It is wicked. It is morally offensive to be a person of faith. Now that just raises this question to me, which I think is actually probably the most important question to consider when it comes to the New Atheist. Because as we said, they're already basically old news. But what was it about wider culture and society which allowed this message to resonate to the point of one author selling 3 million copies of his book? Not saying anything new. Not really presenting any new facts or new arguments. Updated data. But nothing that hadn't been said for decades and decades, if not centuries before, in the case against God. Just general atheist stuff. Why did so many people gravitate to this book? Something changed in culture. Because there's always been strident, arrogant atheists. In the same way, there's always been strident, arrogant Christians. But something in culture allowed this style of argumentation, not the arguments themselves, but the style of argumentation, to gain purchase and traction. And what was that? Dawkins himself says that he had wanted to write The God Delusion in the 1990s, and his American agent and publishers said, "Richard, a book attacking Christianity in the States won't sell." And so he didn't write it. Now, I would suggest that that's probably false. I mean, I think there's been lots of books that have sold quite well you know, in the 1990s and earlier, attacking religion. But nonetheless, his publisher and agent were saying, Richard, there's no market for this book. So something happened between the mid-1990s and the mid-2000s which totally changed the societal niche for this kind of approach to religion. Obviously, 9/11 would be a massive part of that. Because in 9/11, one of the shifts in society was we moved from sort of the view that all religions are relatively harmless if privatized. That is, if you want to be a Muslim, that's fine. Now, don't bring your Islam into the public square. But if you want to go to mosque, you know, knock yourself out. What do we care? Or if you're a Christian, don't bring your biblically based morality into discussions of social issues. But if you want to worship on church and waste your Sunday morning, that's up to you. You know, like by all means. Hey, just don't proselytize in the workplace. Don't evangelize, don't be obnoxious, don't be judgmental, but just, if you want to believe in Jesus, fine, go ahead. Believe in Jesus. 9/11 changed that. In fact, in 9/11, Stanley Fish, one of the arch sort of postmodern theorists, wrote an op-ed piece to the New York Times saying, as much as we've all been saying that there's really no such thing as good and evil, obviously there is. Like, we can't apply a hermeneutic to the events of 9/11 and not walk away saying, evil is inescapable, it does exist, whether our theories allow for it or not. That was wrong. Right? So a lot of the postmodern nonsense, the sort of the flippant, all truth is relative, all morality is relative, when you run into an event like 9/11, it's very hard to glibly maintain that view when you're theorizing in New York. Now, on the other hand, this also shows the horrific ego and cultural centricity of people. That 9/11 makes it impossible to be a moral relativist, but apparently thinking about the Holocaust didn't. I mean, it's just so self-centered. That as long as it was people in Europe, millions and millions and millions, or you know, people in the Pacific Rim, you know, tortured in Japanese prison camps. Well, we can still walk away from that, that morality is relative. But not when it's New York. You know, it's just so arrogant and so blind. But nonetheless, there was a major shift. Almost more importantly, though, and for those of us, I'm not including all of us in this, but we'll just cast the net into general conservative evangelicalism. For people who tend to think that there's a natural connection between rightist politics, conservative Republican, and Christianity, we may have thought that this was a good thing or not have noticed. But something that really bothered a lot of people was when President George W. Bush famously remarked that God told me to attack Iraq. And there were a lot of people who did not think that the president should be listening to direct promptings from heaven for foreign policy. There were a lot of people who didn't think that that was a proper separation of church and state in this. And a lot of people just thought that the Iraqi war was immoral and wrong based on insufficient and misleading evidence. And so no matter how, I'm not asking where you come down on that. I'm not telling you where I come down on it. It's really irrelevant. But for a lot of folk, they're saying, wait a minute. All of a sudden, religion is extremely dangerous. Because religion causes people to fly planes into buildings. And religion causes the leader of the superpower of the day to send an army into war. And so if religion moves people to do things like that, then all of a sudden we just need to stop this really nice veneer of political correctness and relativism where it's okay for you to be religious provided you just keep your religion in your own home, because apparently religious people who are devout can't do that. And I would suggest, actually, that that is the case. I mean, that's one of the things, as Christians, we are not able to do that, right? I mean, no matter what society says, no matter how much society tries to marginalize believers, there comes a point where you have to say, well, I'm really sorry, but I can't come into the public square dispassionately and autonomous pretending that I'm not a believer. That's not possible for me to do. And in a free and open society, in a democratic society, actually, I think that it's wrong for you to try to insist on that. You know, where did secularism get so privileged that all of a sudden the default is atheistic secularism? That's the only voice permitted in the public square. Well, who decided that? That's as imperialistic as anything. And so you have to let me come and speak out of my deepest heart and mental convictions as a member of society. My deepest heart and mental convictions are shaped and informed by Scripture and the Lordship of Jesus Christ. But I have every right to speak out of that. And a Muslim has every right to speak out of their religious beliefs. And an atheist has every right to speak out of their worldview. That's part of being a democratic society. But part of democracy is you can't just sort of arbitrarily or by fiat decide, well, we're just going to exclude people. Especially when it's done, interestingly enough, in the name of tolerance. So with George Bush and September 11th, and also just the shifting moral zeitgeist, the time ghost that just moves through the world. Morality shifts. Foucault has actually done a very good job demonstrating this. It used to be thought in civilized Europe that the right punishment for orphan children stealing a loaf of bread in the market was hanging. And that was justice. Not many people believe that that's right today. Used to be not too long ago that a lot of Bible-believing Christians were fighting against slavery and fighting for slavery. And they were both using the Bible. But if you want some very, very interesting material, read Robert L. Dabney, a great Presbyterian professor and theologian, who's the aide-de-camp of Stonewall Jackson. Written a very interesting biography on Jackson, actually. Really interesting. But also has written a treatise, In Defense of Virginia, where he defends the Virginian economy and autonomy and institution of slavery after the Civil War. Very interesting. And he's arguing from the Bible. Right? And so most of us today would say, well, that's obviously, slavery is abhorrent. It's an abomination before God. And we all want to be very careful to draw massive distinctions between antebellum slavery in the United States and slavery in Israel. And I understand all of that. We can make errors of equivocation. We shouldn't allow slavery in the Bible to be shaped and thought through the categories of slavery in the United States. They're vastly different systems, right? One word doesn't always mean the same thing. However, when you start reading the Bible, when you've come to a place where you very clearly are against slavery, when you have a society, again, regardless of what we think in terms of the morality, sometimes you have to try to put yourself intentionally in someone else's worldview. If you're coming from a society where you really believe that women should have not only equal rights with men, but that women are in every way equal to men, and that any sort of complementarian understanding of home or church or society is the height of misogyny and patriarchal, you know, privilege and discrimination, you're going to read the Bible, and all of a sudden the Bible is teaching things that are immoral. The Bible is teaching the subjugation of women. It doesn't seem to be saying too many negative things about slavery. It seems to be endorsing it, actually, depending on which text you read. And what about the sexual revolution in the 60s and 70s? Autonomy. Personal autonomy is the great and almost only good to a large number of people in our society. And so when you start getting shifts in society where biblical views of manhood and womanhood and home and family, totally broken down, the opposite is now put on a pedestal as morally good, where things like slavery, totally an abomination, sexual ethics, you know, relationship between men and women, and even almost more importantly in terms of ethics and morality, you start working through in a post-Holocaust world and a post-9/11 world and a post, you know, Gulf War world, and all of a sudden you go back and you start reading texts where God commands the haram. God commands the total destruction of every man, woman, and child in Canaan, and all of a sudden, that doesn't seem like a morally good command. Genocide. And so how do you defend God when the Bible is teaching genocide? Now, you want to repackage it. It's not genocide. It's justice and all the rest. But you just have to understand. I mean, I think for us as evangelicals, we're just so naturally in a realm where we hopefully at some level understand the holiness and the justice of God and all of the rest. But you have to understand, if people aren't believers, how do you think they're going to read a text like that? And if they don't believe that God exists or that God speaks directly to presidents telling them to go to war, they believe that Moses and Joshua were doing the exact same thing George W. Bush was doing. A non-existent God really gave a non-existent message that it resulted in the destruction of thousands and thousands of innocent people. That's the way you read the text. You're almost incapable of reading it any other way. So there's this new mentality in the heart and in the intellect, in wide spots in our society, which basically says religion is dangerous, religion is poisonous. Hitchens' subtitle was God is not great, how religion poisons everything. And it results in death. It literally results in death. So one of the famous aphorisms that the New Atheists quote all the time is, you know, bad people will do bad things. But for good people to do bad things requires religion. In other words, the people who flew the planes into the World Trade Center, they may have been bad people doing bad things, or they may have been good people who were convinced to do bad things, which they never would have done if it wasn't for their religion. If it wasn't for the teaching of jihad, they never would have done what they did. If it wasn't for, you know, George W. Bush's evangelicalism, with God's direct message to him to go to war, then there may not have been all of that destruction in the Gulf. So the one thing to understand then, again, and this is sort of moving as from the New Atheists almost as a springboard and then dropping them, because they're not the names that are going to be cited very often in the future. But still, there is a large cultural mentality with a lot of people where now when they hear that you're a Christian, you have to understand, for a number of people, the first response when they hear that you are a Christian has nothing to do with your theological and religious convictions. The first thing they think is that you're a bigot. Yeah. You have to understand that. That you're a bigot. You're a homophobic bigot. Yeah. And stupid to boot, right? Probably ugly too. But at least that. You know, you are at least, at a minimum, a bigot. And bigotry is immorality. To claim to be a Christian today, a lot of people will hear you self-identifying as someone who's immoral. You are an immoral person because of the religious convictions that you have. And not only, and this is what's so important to understand, you are not only immoral, but you are potentially dangerous. Your religious views are wicked, immoral, and may motivate you to do dangerous things. To hurt people, to kill people. Now that's quite an interesting cultural read, isn't it? And so now, if you're representing yourself as a follower of Jesus Christ, you're immoral and dangerous. Now, we don't want to overdraw the conclusions either. I mean, too often in our evangelical circles, we just swing the pendulum all over the map and we overreact, and then we get a hold of one part of a prism of truth And we forget that there are all kinds of other prisms, too. So there's a ton of people in society who haven't read the New Atheist either, who can't name them either. And there's a ton of people in society who don't think that Christians are immoral and bigoted. They don't think about Christians at all. Right? Like, you're just not on their radar. You're not important enough for them to care. And so we don't want to sort of get all primed up that the next person I talk to who's not a Christian is going to think I'm this horrible, immoral bigot. There's a good chance they're just not going to care about you at all. And if you start talking, then it might be nice. Like, you know, it's cute for you to have your little faith, and if that helps you, so what? But there are much, much more important things, like updating your Facebook status. So, you know, I'm just going to move on with my life. So you just need to be aware of that, too. There are still a whole lot of people who are relativists and pluralists and all the rest, right? But there is a large number of people who have this view of religion, immoral and dangerous. Now, that's something to consider. It bears in mind then, or it requires us to bear in mind, how do we evangelize in a culture like this? Because again, the new atheists are not, in a sense, leading the culture. But what they're doing is that they are exposing the drift the culture is already engaged in. Okay. There are also other people. I think, I'm not sure if you've heard of Neil deGrasse Tyson. Familiar with Neil deGrasse Tyson? See, I think of, and Lawrence Krauss. Familiar with Lawrence Krauss? I think that Neil deGrasse Tyson and Lawrence Krauss are going to be much more influential long term than Dawkins and some of these other guys. And the reason is this. The reason is they aren't nearly as strident as Dawkins. In fact, deGrasse Tyson and Krauss are actually on record as basically saying to Dawkins, listen, you're supposed to be a public communicator for, you know, when he was at Oxford, his second professorship was in being the Charles Simeon chair for the public understanding of science. And he's saying, and these guys are saying, to be a teacher means you can't just say these things are true. You actually have to communicate it in a way that people will accept. And calling everyone who disagrees with you an idiot is not the best way of getting them to listen to you. So you need to tamp down the rhetoric in order to give people a hearing. And Krauss, Harris is more like this, actually. Harris is very self-deprecating, very funny, very urbane. But Krauss and Neil deGrasse Tyson, they're far more jokey and far less likely to insult people. And for that reason alone, are far more likely to actually be heard in society. I mean, deGrasse Tyson, he's a brilliant physicist, as is Krauss. And you know, he basically says, you know, everyone wants to claim me as an atheist. I'm not an atheist, I'm an agnostic. And a lot of my atheist colleagues, they want to tell me that it's the same thing. Says, but it's not. He's like, I'm open to the existence of God. There isn't any good evidence that God exists, you know, but I'm open to that. And he says, but I'm not going to become an atheist. I just think it's ludicrous to self-identify by what you don't believe. He's like, I don't play golf. Like, I can't imagine joining a club of people who are agolfists. You know, who all they do is they get around and, you know, they gather together all the time and they just talk about how they don't play golf. And he's like, I'm not going to waste my life doing that. He's like, if you want to do that, you go right ahead. He's like, I'm not going to be an atheist. I'm not going to sit around all day talking about what I don't believe. I'm going to go ahead and do something positive with my life. If you want to be a believer, fine. I don't think that that's intellectually justifiable, but just go away. Just go do what you want. It's fine. But I'm not going to go and join the atheist guild because I think they're wasting their time. Now, I think that that kind of approach will resonate with far more people long term than the kind of arrogant stridency that has already turned off an equally large number of people that is attracted, if not even more. So then, just quickly, three major points that these guys have been making. The first, obviously, which will not be any surprise whatsoever to you now, is that God is immoral. It is, again, the change, the newness is not merely the assertion that God doesn't exist. The newness is the assertion that the way God is depicted in the Bible is absolutely horrific. And that morally, God can't be the standard of good because quite clearly, he fails to even live up to basic goodness himself in terms of how he's revealed in Islam and Judaism and Christianity. Now again, this has also been argued. at great length in the past. I mean, at some level, almost all of this is a repackaged 21st century updating of things that people were saying before the French Revolution. Right? I mean, don't forget that the French Revolution was really no friend of religion, right? And that was a long time ago. People were raving against the morality of, you know, the Roman Catholic Church and the debasement of the human mind and soul and morality on Christian terms and all of the rest. However, Dawkins says, quote, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. Those of us schooled from infancy in his ways can become desensitized to their horror." End quote. After reading that, you just really wish that he'd be clear about what he thinks. Hitchens.
Let us know.
Quote, "The cobbled together ancient Jewish books had an ill-tempered and implacable and bloody and provincial God, who was probably more frightening when he was in a good mood, the classic attribute of the dictator." End quote. These kinds of statements, again, resonate with sort of an undergrad type set, and resonate with the same sort of level of interaction that you get on a lot of online forums, right? And this is one of the things that you see online, is through the being anonymous online allows people to just say ludicrously insulting things. Christians are not immune from this. And I think, you know, one of the things that we almost wish is that there could be some special revelation given today outlining ethics for online interactions, you know, amongst believers. But this is the sort of thing that does well online, which is why in a lot of ways the New Atheists have also been, you know, what propelled it was social media, which is, you can try to see this arc, again, with Dawkins sort of rising up through social media and sort of taking himself out through social media, kind of like Donald Trump. You know, you sort of get a bit of an arc, you know, social media, friend or foe, it depends on the day, you know, it depends on how you're reading things. But this is the unvarnished view. This is their view of God. And you'll say, well, how can you back that up? Now, this is something off to the side that you do want to say. There are all kinds of unguarded statements which are never backed up through citation. So, Hitchens says, God's more frightening when he's in a good mood. I thought, well, I would love to see one text that indicates that. Right? Like, what's one text where because of God being in a good mood, he releases horror and devastation? I mean, you just don't see that. So it's just, those are the kind of the throwaway lines, right? That's in there. You know, anyone can say anything they want, but there's absolutely nothing to pin it on. Well, some of the things that they will talk about then. Obviously, we've already talked about some misogyny, hatred of women, genocide, destruction of Canaanites, killing of children. Long a chestnut of liberal theology, no justification for the atonement, God presumably kills his son on a cross, murder of your son, cosmic child abuse, you know, we've heard all those things, not from atheists, but from, you know, theologians, sometimes that's a false dichotomy, isn't it? Sometimes through atheist theologians, you know, we've heard these sorts of things for a long time. Slavery, homophobia, hell. Yeah. One of the things that's argued at great length today is that Jesus isn't even a good moral teacher. How could a good moral teacher teach about hell? How could any God? And again, if you just step outside of your evangelical worldview for a moment, let alone the Reformed worldview, just step out for a second. And you read texts and the narrative is God, who is perfectly content, perfectly self-sufficient, lacking nothing, creates billions and billions of people who, through no fault of their own, because Adam's sin, I did not sin in the Garden of Eden, at least at some level, I think we'd all acknowledge that. But somehow I'm guilty. Somehow I also have that nature. And not being able, because of a nature I inherited that I did not merit, not being able to not sin, I sin, and I'm damned for it, in a torture chamber that makes the death camps in the Second World War look like Disneyland. Forever and ever and ever and ever. And a God who needed nothing decided to create me for that purpose, knowing that that's what I would endure. Step outside of the evangelical worldview. Does that sound like a moral thing to do? It's not hard to sympathize at some level. I hope that's not blasphemous to you. It's not hard to sympathize at some level with why a non-Christian, without the reverent high view of God that we have, hopefully, reads that and says, that's not moral. And anyone who teaches that and says, and the only way to avoid that is to believe in me and me alone, how's that being a good moral teacher? Now, on the other hand, it totally sidesteps the question as to whether or not it's true. Because if there is a hell, and if Jesus is the only way of being reconciled to God, then there's nothing immoral about saying so. In fact, it's the height of morality to teach the truth and to warn people. Nevertheless, if you don't believe in God and you don't believe in hell, then it's very difficult to believe that Jesus is a sane moral teacher, because he's teaching these things. He's teaching that he is God. It's not a normal, balanced thing for someone to do. He's teaching people to hate their father and mother in comparison to their loyalty to him. That's not a normal, balanced thing to do. That characterizes cult leaders all over the world. And so again, it's not difficult in some ways to understand when the text is selectively read how you can begin to form these views of God and even of Jesus. Certainly the Apostle Paul. Now, the second thing, then, is that because God is immoral, then religion is bad for the world. Religion poisons everything. Religion causes good people to do bad things. And there's usually a hand-waving acknowledgement, too. Yes, religion does a lot of good things, too. And you can look at education, healthcare, kindness, charity, whatever. Religion does a lot of good. But religion does do a lot of bad things, too. And we are being dishonest if we say anything differently, even when it comes to the history of the Christian church. And again, there's all ways of nuancing this, and I would argue that there's been great periods of time when when what was referred to as the Christian church wasn't the Christian church at all. Rather, it was a corrupt political quasi-religious institution doing all sorts of things that Jesus would have found abhorrent. Right. Nevertheless, again, from outside of that circles, you look in and you say, Inquisition. And you're not differentiating evangelical from Roman Catholic. Child sex abuse scandal and cover-up. You do realize that as much as for us as evangelicals, we can say, well, that was the Roman Catholic Church, that wasn't us. People in the world make no distinction between us and the Roman Catholic Church at all. That's a nuance that is totally lost in wider society. Okay. So that's the church. Crusades. Right? And you go on and on and on. Michael Ruse, in his Oxford publication, Atheism, What Everyone Needs to Know, comes down this way. And he is as balanced as an atheist I've ever read in terms of weighing these things out. He comes down and he says, the truth of the matter is, there's absolutely no way of evaluating whether or not religion has done more good or evil in the history of the world. Because no matter what you cite, we can talk all day long about the incredibly good things religion is responsible for and has motivated. Incredible acts of sacrifice and love and social justice. Religion has been a force for tremendous good. And we can talk all day long about all the things that have been evil and harmful that religion has been responsible for too. So to me, I don't think there's any way of evaluating. How do you begin to sort of weigh out the Inquisition
versus Mother Teresa's work in India. I mean, how do you balance those two things out? They were both motivated by religion.
What's the metric? They'll also argue that religion, by definition, includes a principle of incredulous faith, blind faith, and authoritarianism, so that we blindly submit ourselves to ancient books written in the Bronze Age, rather than moving along with the moral zeitgeist and with developments in technology. They say incredulous faith combined with authoritarianism will always lead to evil, eventually. And that's what we see in the history of religion. Now, it is worth saying, we could camp out on this on a long time, but I don't have a long time, is that it's not just religion that does this. Every ideology, every controlling meta-narrative can also produce evil. Some of the things that, this is actually one of the things that you see in the New Atheists doing all the time. They're always scrambling to say, no. Hitler. Clearly, that had nothing to do with his atheism. Nothing. In fact, Dawkins tries to make Hitler a bit of a failed Catholic, which is a pretty tough stretch. Stalin. Probably religious. Because you know, of course, Stalin spent a year in an Orthodox seminary. Christian. You know, okay, like if that's the case, atheism, communism, that's not to blame. That's not the problem. It was his year at the Orthodox seminary. And that's where you were going, oh, come on, guys. I mean, let's just admit that any ideology can lead to abuse and destruction. It's not only religious. The third thing is that science is the answer. There's sort of the scientism in terms of epistemology. Science is the only reliable way of knowing what's true. Dawkins actually says very interestingly in his memoirs, quote, "I have always been interested in deep questions of existence, the questions that religion aspires and fails to answer, but I have been fortunate to live in a time when such questions are given scientific rather than supernatural answers." So what he's saying is you can understand the deep questions of existence and meaning and purpose, not through religion. That's been tried and failed. But science is now the key to understanding these things. Sam Harris argues in The Moral Landscape that science is the key to understanding morality. That we'll be able to understand, we'll be able to frame out a whole ethical universe on the basis of science. Interestingly enough, though, Sam Harris's latest book, I mean, it's just a couple years old now, it's called Waking Up. And Harris argues, this is a fascinating read. Harris argues that basically a materialistic worldview is insufficient for living a life of meaning and purpose and integration. What? That's interesting. That's this worldview. Because Dawkins, again, the Dawkins God delusion, he's arguing at the end that it's atheism and science and materialism that actually allows you to live a nice, meaningful life. Which is when you want to go back to your Nietzsche and your Jean-Paul Sartre and some of these guys and go, like, give me an atheist with a backbone any day, or even a Bertrand Russell who says, the consequences of my atheism is that I could build my life on the foundation of grim, unyielding despair. Give me that guy. Like, don't give me a Dawkins and a Watson who are saying, well, there's no meaning or purpose, but we can still enjoy a good lunch, right? That's their argument. We can still have pleasure today. Well, fine. Harris is saying, it doesn't work that way. Harris is saying, what we really need to do is we need to recognize that our conscious self is an illusion. There is no ego, there is no I, because we're just matter in motion. Our minds are the product of brain states. So there is no identity, there is no you inside of your body. You are just your body, you're just your molecules. But the great problem we all have is we all think that we have this persistent identity. So we need to get past that. The ticket to a happy life is realizing that there is really no you. Well, where do you find how to do that? Buddhist meditation. Buddhist meditation. So what we really need to do is we need to be atheists who practice Buddhist meditation and reject. Of course, now
He says, ah, of course. The Buddhist religious metaphysic is all nonsense. So we got to get rid of the religious metaphysic. But the meditative practice to realize that there is no you, that's the ticket. So now we want to be doing Buddhist meditation as atheistic scientists. And that's going to be what gives us our rewarding life. Not only that, but he also, and this may seem like a cheap shot, I don't mean it to be, it's phrased in a slightly thoughtful way. You may remember Timothy O'Leary, the 1960s Harvard drug culture experiment with LSD intentionally. In some ways, kind of like the teacher in Ecclesiastes. I became drunk. Like I was trying all these different things, but I was still guiding with my mind. You know, I'm wisely choosing to try everything that there is under the sun to see what works. You know, Timothy O'Leary and some of these guys in the drug culture, they're doing the same thing. Harris says LSD and other hallucinogenic drugs can expand your consciousness. He says, I've had some real breakthroughs. Steve Jobs says the same thing, right? The late Steve Jobs says that a lot of his most creative work at Apple was done through LSD vision. Good reason to buy IBM. Harris says, it can expand your consciousness because your brain's also an inhibitor. And a very interesting comment, he says, I hope as my daughters get older, that I'll be able to guide them in their drug taking as they get older. Because I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure they don't smoke tobacco. But I have to realize they're going to smoke marijuana. It's okay. And he says, and if they choose not to take LSD, I may wonder if they have missed out on a shaping experience for their adulthood. What do you think about that? Sometimes you wonder, what does child services think about? So, why are they involved in some cases and not in others? Yeah, pretty soon it'll be required. And these are the same guys who are saying that teaching your children about religion is child abuse. Right. Dawkins, actually, this is causing me to get a lot of trouble. He said that, in some cases, children who have been molested physically have been harmed less than children who have been taught religion. It's more harmful to teach a child about hell than it is to knock out their tooth. Anyway, so with 2 minutes then, how do we engage all of this? Well, the one thing would be this. You defend the Bible by reading the Bible properly. And that's one of the major errors in every atheistic attack on Christianity. They just don't know how to read the Bible. I don't say that unkindly. There's just a total lack of contextual hermeneutics. You're just not paying attention to anything. Just pulling it, and Sam Harris says this himself. He says, when he's talking about the Bible and slavery, he says, now there are other texts, but I'm not going to talk about those because people have been cherry-picking the Bible for years. So he just does the same thing. It would be very interesting if we did that when it came to the lab and in science. Well, people have been cherry-picking, Darwin's writings for years, so we're just going to do that too. They get all upset about those kinds of things. So just learn how to read the Bible properly. And to work hard not to adopt the same tone. And to be honest, I think I see this in Rabbi Zacharias' book with Vince Vitale. There's kind of this sneering approach to Dawkins, the same kind of like mirroring the way Dawkins talks about Christians. And I understand, and Ravi's a brilliant guy and is in these circles and all the rest. It must get really wearying and tiring. But I remember reading these just like these kind of snide comments about Dawkins. And going, I agree with you, but that tone is a little bit off-putting, and we have to be very careful that we answer a fool according to their folly. But we need to be very careful that we do so with a different moral standard and attitude. More importantly, we want to expose the contradictions in the system. So Dawkins says, science has no methods for deciding what is ethical. And he also says, in a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we would expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. Well, that's fine. But if that's your worldview, then how on earth did Christians become immoral? How did we become evil when there's no evil in your worldview?
What is this massive contradiction? You can't accuse us of being immoral when you've denied the category of morality. We just are. Now, not only that, this becomes a very important critique for both morality and intellect. The New Atheists are arguing that we're all stupid for not believing them. But our minds are nothing but molecules in motion. And molecules in motion work on the basis of natural law and predictive states. So whatever state the physical world is in now, it is in this state because of the way the physical world was in the immediate time prior. And back and back and back and back and back. Which means that if all the world is matter in motion, everything that takes place is accounted for on a macro level, not a micro quantum level, I understand that. But on a macro level, everything that takes place is just taking place on the basis of natural law, which literally means you cannot do or think differently than you do. So it's not a matter of the atheist being smart or the Christians being dumb. We literally could not help but have our molecules in motion generate the thoughts that they do. Which means the truth value of all of our beliefs are inscrutable. We have no idea if what we think is better than someone else's. We just have no context-independent way of stepping outside of the molecular motion in our thoughts. No matter how you read a book, you are determined by the trajectory of the Big Bang to think about it what you think about it. And to do what you do. So Harris, in his book Free Will, actually says we need to realize that no matter what crimes people commit, they're not guilty. They're not morally responsible. We might have to quarantine them so they don't hurt other people the way we quarantine sick people, but they haven't done anything morally wrong. They couldn't help it. There's no free will. We're just all determined. But if that's the case, then so are the atheists. Their views are determined. Their morality is determined. And in their worldview, there is no morality at all. So these are the sorts of things that are not just true of the new atheists, they're true of all atheists together, that you start probing. Because long after the fad of the new atheists are gone, and we're already seeing that, the dissipation of it, these are the sorts of inescapable baseline realities of the materialistic universe. Determinism, no real morality, no meaning, no purpose. But we absolutely can't live that way because we've been designed by God differently. And so one of the things I try to remind myself of is the new atheists are wrong, but not because I'm smarter than they are. The new atheists are wrong and I'm right because God has revealed truth. And our worldview is a revelatory one that comes from the top down, not cobbled up from here to there. But fascinatingly, in the worldview that God has delivered to us, life does make sense. And it's the only coherent way of viewing reality that there is. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you've been very patient, so I guess I'll stop. Mark.